Hello and welcome to the June edition of the Dance Futures podcast, the podcast that discusses dance as a way of life with people who've made it central to theirs. And this month I had the pleasure of talking to choreographer Taos Bertrand ahead of their world premiere of the piece Brutal Syntax, commissioned for the Meltdown Festival, which is curated this year by the French pop icon Christine and the Queens. I had a massive fangirl moment on hearing that Taos had worked with Chris, and we talk a little bit more about that in this episode. Their work, Brutal Syntax, is premiering on Wednesday the 14th of June, and do catch that if you can. There's one show, not two, as I say in this episode, and also lots of the events at the Meltdown Festival are free, but Taos's show is ticketed and you do have to pay, just to clarify that. So I spoke to Taos in France, and it was a really beautiful exchange. They are someone working across multiple genres, lots of collaborations with different disciplines, visual artists, sound. And I really got the kind of impression, speaking to Taos also, of a kind of theoretically informed practice and weaving together a huge kind of eclectic mix of influences, specifically exploring our relationship to popular culture, which is something that I'm super curious about myself. And if you've listened to other episodes, you will have heard me talk about that, because often the things that we investigate in academia can feel like there's a hierarchy around what is available to be studied. And I'm really excited by people who are troubling those distinctions and boundaries between what counts as art and sociality and popular versus high elite practices, etc. So that was all right on point for me. I also just want to make a quick apology that the final section of the podcast, in which I digest the interview with recent dance and choreography graduate Luca Vaccari, the sound on that has not come through. I have had two technical hitches in recent times, which I've never had before recording this podcast, so I really apologise that Luca's voice is really quiet. I decided to include it anyway because I think what he says is worth hearing, but do turn it up and tune in to that. And I will see you on the other side. Okay, welcome Taos Bertrand to the Dance Futures podcast. It's so exciting to have this time to speak with you.
Hello, Ruth.
And you're in France at the moment, I believe.
Yeah. I'm not in Paris, actually. I'm in the west of France at my parents' home.
Amazing. Yeah, we were just talking about the possible interruptions to this conversation that might occur. So I will give you a proper introduction, obviously, but can you describe to me, as somebody who doesn't know your work very well, how you would describe your practice? So I always think of it like a dinner party conversation. And I think that my understanding is that you originally trained as a contemporary dancer, but you've also kind of moved into these contexts that might be more described as popular. I'm doing that in inverted commas a little bit. Yeah. And I suppose for me, it's always really interesting, like troubling those sort of distinctions between these contexts. But I wondered a bit about your trajectory and how you would describe it initially to somebody who's like, so what is your work in dance? What do you do?
Yeah, sure. I don't know if I'm, I was trained as a contemporary dancer. So first of all, I'm really sorry for my French accent.
We love it. We will love it. Please, no one should ever have to apologize for a beautiful accent like that.
Thank you. But yes, I just briefly, I started dance. I started learning dance when I was 18, and then I did 3 years of formation in the conservatory of Paris, and then I I started working on stage, working on stage and learning on stage. And then I started to develop my own work as a choreographer also. I've always been, I think, interested in the link, even if the link is a bit metaphorical or symbolical. But I've always been interested in the link between writing as a as a practice and choreographing or dancing as a write as a writing practice too. So actually, I've always been, I mean, my relation to to let's say to what I read and to what I embody or to what I project or to what I want to express is definitely linked because reading is also my way to be connected with different temporalities and actually in our also contemporary time. So I'm always trying and I think I'm not successful, and I like not to be successful in it, but I'm always trying to be contemporary.
Interesting.
But yeah, with pop culture, I think what I will do at Meltdown is very connected with pop culture, definitely.
So that's so yeah, that this takes me straight to a question that I was going to ask later, but this is the nature of these this is the nature of these things. So yeah, you're presenting your work Brutal Syntax at Meltdown Festival at the South Bank on the 14th of June, which we will talk more about. But in relation to what you've just said, so two things. Makes me so happy when a dancer choreographer talks about reading and writing as an important part of their practice, because I teach a lot of theory to undergraduate students in dance and choreography. So I'm always like, yes, you see, this is so relevant and important. But sometimes it comes a little bit later how those two things meet, I guess, and inform one another. But yes, reading as a practice and dialogue as a kind of technique, if you like, as part of a dance process is so fascinating. And I was interested in the title of your work, because obviously syntax is a very linguistic term. So, and my interpretation of brutal syntax is kind of like the violence of language. And I don't know if that's, I've completely misinterpreted that. But yeah, I wondered whether how much then that plays into this piece. I guess, you know, it's the question seems too simplistic to say, what's it about? But in a way, I'm curious your starting points,
Sure.
I guess. Yeah.
Sure. It's not simple at all. I will try. I will try to answer. It's not easy for me, but I will try to answer. Basically, the last times I'm in a studio, of course, we have our, I think, intimate part of intimate and theoretical part, theoretical process to read things, to be closely moved by words, by poetry, by theory, also the virtual aspect of the world, something that is that has a materiality, but a materiality that is definitely more open than our, let's say, simple body. Not simple body, but the projection of the language is definitely more open than our single body. And I'm not sure about what I'm saying, but let's say that is
Let's run
that
with
is
it. Let's run with
let's say it.
it.
But the more I'm in the studio and also for the con with the context of this piece, which is a commission work, I have mostly 10 days of rehearsals. So basically you need to produce materials, and I will say more about the materials, but I need to be let's say, in a very fresh and powerful desire of materiality. When I'm in the studio with my body in 10 days, I need to say with the people I'm working with, I need to produce something with my body, and I love it to produce something that is very material, that is very dense, that is very and closely in relation to velocity, to the weight of the body, to the time of the body, to the relation to the music, to something that is. And I'm coming back to the title, because yeah, this brutal syntax for me is really a relation with trouble, with lust, with also a kind of approach of psychic disorders, or let's say neuroatypicality, or you know, the also symbolism, organicity, you know, this. Because if I want to produce, or if I want to, yeah, if I have the desire to produce, let's say, a language that is a bit displacing myself and displacing the audience, I need to be in connection with something that is definitely not graspable. And this way of approaching the language as something also, yes, with this violence also of connected to also the question of the gender. You know, when language is often naming things, naming bodies, naming people, naming genders, I think we need like poetic language that are a bit breaking everything, you know, as something that is breaking the shell. And yes, I've been really influencing by mostly, let's say, two texts. The first one is an article that I read on Iflux, and the title of the article is, sorry for my accent again, but is like a real veil, like a bad analogy, dissociative style and trans aesthetics. And the article is by Maxi Valenhorst, I think, if I'm sorry for the pronunciation.
No, yeah.
And the second text is just out for a few weeks, and is Raving by Mackenzie Work, which is a trans philosopher from the US. And both texts are pointing this way of this question of materiality for trans bodies.
The title of the first one is so evocative already, like a real veil, and what was the second bit? A bad analogy.
Yes, it's that. Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, I love it when a text has a title that already opens up your thinking, right? You're kind of like, I'm already sort of puzzling what that means and how it might apply, to, like you say, to those identities and the way that we're grappling with the language around that. Fascinating. Yeah. Thank you. I'm writing them down, but obviously it's recorded so I can have a look at them. It's fascinating. Yeah. So I was going to ask a bit, I guess, about, you know, identity and how much that plays into your work. You know, some of the people that I speak to, their identity is very central to the work that they create. Arguably, maybe it always is. We can't sort of remove ourselves from ourselves. But there is also, I guess the way we focus in on the things that we're exploring and the way that we're projecting out into the world, how central identity is. We do make choices around that and framing as well, right? Like how we frame our work and put it out into the world. So I'm curious about how central your sort of the way that you choose to identify how central that is to your choreographic work.
I think I'm from two schools in theater. As a student, let's say, I'm from the school of a kind of not a refusal of identity, but a suspicion about identity, because I don't know if I'm believing in identity anymore. I don't know if, you know, when I read Beckett, when I read people like this, when I read, I don't know if I'm believing in identity. But I'm definitely interested in the process, in the political process of a language, affirming a materiality on stage. So I don't know if I'm really focused about my identity. I've been working in my last work on my first solo was about my experience of person personics. As an adopted person,
okay.
So it was my first work. Then I worked more in the question of symbolism with another dread when we are one. I was a male at that point, a gay man, and I was dancing with Leonor, and she was a girl, and we were like in this kind of question of the androgynous. So the question of androgyny was very, and the myth also of androgyny was very close to the work. So when I come back a bit to what I've done sometimes, I don't know if identity was the point, my identity was the point, but definitely my way of creating images of yes, I think my way of creating images was definitely linked to questions that are very connected to my body, definitely.
Yeah. Of course.
But what I want to say is that I am also, I definitely understand the our very contextual desire of naming and serving specific needs of recognition for some forgotten communities, forgotten bodies, of and I definitely understand how language can be a political response to oblivion.
I think that's, I love that you say you're not sure if you believe in identity anymore, because it's immediately very kind of liberating just to hear those, just to even hear those words, right? It's like, oh what relief, almost, you know. But yeah, like you say, you know, we're also working within these structures and different lived experiences where sometimes that language also has power to speak back to these structures. And so, yeah, it's navigating perhaps those spaces where we can create that. Well, this is one of the reasons why dance, I feel, has such a great role, I suppose, to play in these sort of dance utopian dance futures that I imagine, which is these kinds of fluid, more ambiguous, actually, the way that we relate to one another and creating those little micro processes and investigations and questions through the body. So thank you. That's a really thought-provoking answer. And I guess I kind of can't not mention the big sort of name drop, which is that you've worked with Christine and the Queens. And that's definitely a bit of a sort of fangirl moment for me, like, ooh. And their show, Red Car ou les Adorables Étoiles, my turn to apologize for my bad accent. and I guess again, I feel like they are troubling some, and when I say troubling, I mean that in a good way, right? Like disturbing the peace in a positive sense of like, so that we have to all ask ourselves questions. Also in terms of sort of, again, how popular culture, how they're working with this kind of pop aesthetic sometimes, but it's becoming more into performance art, and that they're able to kind of cross those lines in ways that invite in different demographics who've come to their work for different reasons. And this is one of the things I really enjoy about it. And I suppose I'm curious about, yeah, your role, your working process, and also how that is for you to be sometimes being in a role where you're supporting somebody else's vision in a way.
Yes, I was very lucky to be part of the last tour of Red. So we've been touring for 2 years all together.
Wow.
The show was choreographed by the Collective La Horde with the dancers in close collaboration with the dancers. So the dancers have been very important in the context of the creation, and the context of the creation of the gestures, characters, avatars of the show. It was a very intense time, intensive time also to be closely performing with them. It was also, I have some very printed memories with some, you know, Glastonbury, enormous,
amazing, yeah,
enormous stage with an amazing audience, very generous audience in front of us, you know, this kind enormous wave of energy when you are giving something, you know, on stage, and when you receive something after, there is something very magical inside. And I think they are very, or he is very connected with this kind of generosity also. And then we worked a bit together for the last album for Red Car ou Les Adorables Étoiles, and I was starting my gender transition, and I think it was a time in September, in last September, where my body was so demanding of drawing a language, and I think we were quite connected with this aspect of writing something. He wrote me a few months ago telling me, "Oh, what do you do in June?" I was like, "Oh, I'm free at the beginning of June," and he told me, "Do you want to be part of the meltdown?" And I was like, "Whoa!"
Amazing, amazing.
Thank you.
That
so
must
much.
Have been a really, yeah, a lovely email to receive.
So it was 2 months ago. So you know, it's fast also.
Recent, yes, right. And so this is this what you're saying about having 10 years in 10 years. That's tender. That would be more
10
like
years.
That would be more
maybe
like
one
a
day.
Nice slow process. I was thinking about 10 days in the studio as also, you know, like you're saying, and this kind of, yeah, how these different working processes inform also how we can create these structures again around what we're doing, right? And so
from nothing,
again, what I love about dance and performance, you know, we're going to create something from nothing. We just go in a room with nothing, we come out with
nothing.
Come out with something.
It's like so, you know, if maybe you want me to speak about like concrete things, I wanted to invite Kelman Duran, which is an LA is a producer from LA, working a lot with ambient music and dancehall.
And dancehall, do you say? Ambient and dancehall?
Yeah,
oh, amazing.
Ambient and dancehall. So I really wanted to have this I wanted to work with him actually. So I wrote him. We decided to work on three, four, let's say, pop culture reminiscence for me. So I wanted to work with Ciara, Like a Boy. So this kind of amazing track from the 2000, all the pieces about the reminiscences of the 2000 years, actually. Everything is about this. The stylism, the music, the inspiration also for the movement. Everything is about video clips, dance movies from the 2000, dance movie that I loved when I was a
nice.
teenager. So it's a lot about a teenager time. I wanted to work with gymnastic reborn artist. So there is two gymnasts in the show with like this kind of amazing, beautiful, ornamental language of the ribbon.
Oh,
so
wow.
yeah and we are three dancers plus two ribbon gymnasts, and yeah, I'm trying to weave something with Ciara, Cardi B, also Julius Eastman, which is an American queer composer, quite forgotten in the history, but he was definitely at the same let's say at the same no, he was not at the same level of recognition than Lamonte Young, Steve Reich, Philip Glass, but he was from this time, you know. And so yes, I wanted to make this piece as a also a pop celebration of feminine figures and also hybridation of different materials that are a bit brutally assemblés, quoi.
Yeah, I'm kind of almost wishing that we did have the video, because some of your hands movements are so great, you know, when we're trying to find words sometimes, and it's like, yeah, you say that materiality of like, how can I, my hands almost create them. But yeah, that sounds like a lot of different things kind of coming together.
Yeah, I'm trying to in 20 minutes.
Yes.
In 25 minutes of show.
Wow. But I guess, you know, again, that's kind of part of the popular culture sort of, you know, framing or kind of influences of how there is a bit of this sort of cut and paste and kind of bringing together these multiplicities on multiplicities and really acknowledging that is kind of the culture that we exist in and that we create in. And so there's something wonderful, I think, about kind of just, yeah, owning that and bringing that all onto the picture. I love that. I was looking at the press release for Meltdown Festival, which in general just looks amazing, you know, loads of free events and, you know, sensory walks and, you know, music from edges that I just wouldn't otherwise come across, you know. It looks really great, and they talk about it being featuring trailblazing artists pushing at the boundaries, right? And I was thinking, like, so I wondered how you felt about being a trail. Do you feel like a trailblazer? How do you feel about being described as one of those artists? Do you know what a trailblazer is, even? Yes.
A trailblazer.
Yes,
no,
it's like
your. Check.
Oh, I love it. Okay, great. I
let
kind
me
of
check.
Love
a
that
trailblazer.
It's, yeah, it's a real like English thing. I wonder where it comes from, actually. I'd be quite interested in a kind of nerdy way. It's like you're out
I'm
there.
Precursor. No,
you're
I'm
like...
not.
I'm
definitely
I
not.
Love it. I love that you're so clear.
No, I'm not.
No, that's not me.
I'm not. No, not yet.
No,
definitely not. I'm definitely not a precursor or une précurseuse. No.
Okay.
No, no. I'm trying to be the more contemporary I can be.
Yeah.
I'm
So of the
trying.
now. of the now, here and
of the
now.
now, of approaching a body on stage or bodies on stage. I think I think I have a lot of limitations. I think I have also some you know, dance sometimes is also carrying visions, geometric visions of stage, or some geometry that sometimes you wanted to leave. I think I'm sometimes maybe a bit traditional in the ways I'm seeing bodies on stage in my work, or I could maybe sometimes, I need sometimes to come to have this mutation from 2D to 3D. You know, because when I was playing video games, the characters at the beginning was in 2D and then it was in 3D. but I think I'm not a precursor. I'm definitely trying to go in the unknown every time and every time and yeah, I think I needed to be a modern to be contemporary. I think I've been quite modernist, and I think the more I do things, the more I'm contemporary. I hope so. And it's not only about a fashion or a tendency.
No,
I think it's really a kind of approaching the body also as a digital materiality, as you know, to be prophetic, not prophetic as a prophet, but prophetic as something that is telling something about the future that you don't know. I think this is for me a real trailblazer.
This is what I was going to say. That sounds pretty trailblazing to me, but yeah.
I think this is someone who is definitely saying about future. I think.
So it's perfect.
Not my job to say.
It's perfect. This is why just, you know, opening up language, right? It's so interesting. You one word like that, and then you're like, what all these. How it opens up these questions. So I'm glad I asked. And I guess it really helps me into my final question about dance futures, right? Which is because you're talking about this about, and I guess it's always somehow about my, what might a dance future look like? That's for, somehow it's about, are there any things that you see missing now or something that you feel would be in the dance future that we would like to create? And it's a huge question on one level, but on another level you can also shrink it down to be very specific to your work if you like, but also sector related in a sense, or the related to the practice of choreography in general. Maybe it's about having 10 years to make a piece instead of 10 days. I don't know. What I mean is it can be very practical, or maybe it's more ideological. And I want to flag also, Taos, that I'm aware we've got 3 minutes left. So I'm wondering if we should start again and then you answer that question on a new link. But I don't have your direct email because I only have Susanna's. So should I, if you put it in the chat and then I can just send you a new link,
because
I don't want it to be rushed. You may only need 3 minutes, but it's nice not to feel
pleasure.
Pressured.
I'm writing you my email address.
Thank you.
So we cut here.
If you write it in the chat and
I'll
then
just
I'll,
in the chat now. Okay.
Yeah. And then I will just send you another link quickly and we can do the final bit on that.
Discuter, voilà.
Radar.cie. Okay, I will just ping you another link and then we can do that last
Perfect.
Bit without
Perfect.
Without the clock going down.
Perfect.
Stresses me out. Ciao.
See you soon. Yeah, if you can repeat, it will be perfect.
So repeat the question. So, dance. So, yeah, we were thinking about dance futures and this relation to what you said about kind of we were thinking about trailblazers and opening into the unknown, perhaps. So, I'm wondering on both practical levels in small ways, maybe, but also ideologically, what does a dance future that you want to be in, that you want to be part of, what does that look like or feel like? What's in that? I know. Wow, big question. Sorry.
I don't know, you know, I'm searching regarding the question of future. I don't know, I'm thinking about a few things. I'm thinking about the text that I love, which is a prophetic culture by Federico Campagna. And the subtitle of the text is Recreation for Adolescence. And
Recreation, did you say?
Recreation for Adolescence,
For adolescence. Okay, which
yeah,
really
c'est
relates
ça.
to what you were talking about your work, kind
Yeah,
of reminiscing about this
yeah,
teenage time, right?
yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't know, maybe. I felt that in some particular times of a life, sometimes you have, even as a child, as a teenager, as an adult, you have like something inside you that is definitely breaking boundaries of imagination, and you have memories of some times like this that are really guiding you in the in the future. So I don't know, I'm always trying, or something inside of me is always trying to be focused on those times actually, and to conceive dance and to practice dance always as a new beginning, never being focused on what I can technically, what I can do, what is my savoir-faire, what is what can I show, what can I. It's not what is really interesting for me. What is really interesting for me, it's the when I see someone who is definitely writing with the guts, with a very conscious aspect, a very conscious feeling of time, space, with, yeah, this question of conscience, and also with the question of the infinity of the unconscious also. This is because we cannot dance as two conscious beings, because dance and maybe grace needs to be forgotten. At some point, you need to forget. You need to forget something. So I don't know. I don't know. Maybe. Yeah, maybe grace of dance is about this, you know, something that is at some point very technological, I can say, and technological because it's a kind of memory, technique, vision, breath, physiological, something that is, and at some point it's like producing a sensation, a profound sensation of unity, which is something that is so precious, because sometimes it's just a glimpse. You feel it, and you can express it, and after it's totally ephemeral. So it's a kind of joy also in
Yeah,
this part, right?
absolutely.
You know,
Yeah, I
there is
love
a joy.
that.
There's a joy in this aspect of soul, of digging into past, present, and future, but just at some point, just accepting that control is not the point. Listening is the point. I think it's always between memory and oblivion, and it's a very as a dancer, huh? as someone, not as a dancer, but as all the spaces we can find in our very segmented capitalistic time, all the spaces we can find to renew with the joy of the imagination of the adolescent, the joy of listening to music, a pop music, a classical music, of reading something, of I don't know, everything, the joy of just being deeply moved by something, and the opening of this sensation. So
yes. Yeah, I'm like inside, I'm like cheering. I'm like, yes. Because this what you're saying about the, I guess, yeah, the significance of those moments of sort of maybe their transcendence, or maybe they're more about actually coming into being, like, which, you know, both of those things somehow are true. In the construct that we're living in, within all the limitations that we're living in, under capitalism. And I think I feel, for me, it's about how can we share more of what we experience in those moments as dancers and movers and people who make and work in this form with the body so centrally. How can we bring that to more people and share that with more people? Because I genuinely think that we will create a better world if more people have access to those experiences, I guess. And I loved what you said about dancers always a new beginning. I feel like that is a really beautiful sentiment to take it, that you have now given to the world. Well, if the world is listening to this podcast.
And if I can do my work good also, which is never something that you can count for. You need to, and I need to, you know, there is a responsibility within that thing also.
Exactly.
As a cultural producer of things. So I think it's at some point very light, and at some point you, I don't know, there is something that you need to deliver, and it's also beautiful to be responsible of this, to deliver something.
Yeah.
You know? And and I love this. I think I have the shoulders for this. So
yeah,
I don't know if I'm a trailblazer, but I have good shoulders.
You have good shoulders. Amazing.
More feminine than before, and I love it.
Oh, that's so beautiful to hear. I'm glad.
I think we are.
The
I
feminine
think we
shoulders
are, beyond.
Are stronger to hold all of this, maybe somehow.
Hope so.
Yeah. Well, and I think, that really resonates with the premise of Meltdown, having a lot of free events to really bring, hopefully, that culture, like I say, to lots of people who can access it as a free event. And I'm really hoping to get up and see your work on the 14th of June. And anyone listening, please check it out, South Bank Centre. There's two performances, I believe. Yeah, 14th on the 14th. Yeah.
There is one.
Oh, one only. Okay.
Yeah, there is one.
One.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's the one I'll be at then.
Yeah, at 7:45.
Not the one that doesn't exist. Thank you so much for your time, Tao. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you and
Me
meet
too.
You. And enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you. You too. Thank you, Ruth.
So we had a great international guest this month, and I don't know what you thought, but I just loved how they apologized for their French accent, which is like so
Oh, no one
divine.
should ever have to
Right?
apologize for an accent as beautiful as that.
Right? I know. I know. So, were there any standout moments for you in Taos's interview, Luca? What did you think?
Yeah, I felt like I really understood their practice and their view of the world once I'd got to the end of the interview, and then I kind of reflected on what had come before. So in a topsy-turvy way, I'm going to start at the end of the interview and work my way back, if that's all right.
Yeah, of course. That's really interesting. Yeah, because I think they were talking quite abstractly at first. So I think I can imagine that that might be harder to grasp for sure.
Yeah, and so forgive me because I'm going to shatter the illusion that everything we record works perfectly first time and say,
What?
like, I hear the raw footage of the interview, and that's
Yeah.
something that listeners maybe don't hear.
Yeah.
But I don't think you plan to keep in the immense thinking time that Taos had before they answered your last question about what their dance future is. And I think it's really important to kind of acknowledge, because I was really moved and touched by how much thought they'd put into answering that question. And that really, for me, solidified everything else that they had said before, because it was so personal to them. It was really a response that I could tell that they wanted to get right, in inverted commas, right?
Yeah,
And
it's
it
so
wasn't.
interesting you say that because I think, yeah, like you say, I said, oh, well, I can edit out that silence, right? And for me, because obviously I'm on Zoom and so I've got the visuals as well, they like, whilst they were thinking, they turned their head and were like looking out of the window. So there's also that thing of how we, you know, like how we ponder and sort of process our thoughts. And that something, there's something sort of very archetypal about that, I think, almost of like just having to like take a different perspective or yeah, view it, or you know, so that you can just lose yourself in that thought process or something. So
Yeah.
that's a really beautiful observation, yeah.
And it's nice to know that it's not bullshit, it's not waffle.
No.
Someone really thinking about how they want to respond to quite a personal, intense question about their future and what their work is gonna So, yeah, that to me was really pertinent. And then I was thinking about the start of the conversation, and then your dialogue about the use of language and its use as a tool, as a weapon, as a communal thing, as a barrier, all these things that language can be. Yeah, I don't know quite what I want to reflect on that with, other than it felt like a very timely conversation.
Yeah, I think, as you say, even just hearing you say that back about, yeah, language as a tool, as a weapon, you know, just these different framings that we can give it or how we kind of understand what we're doing with it, I guess, because obviously we're just in it so much, aren't we? We're, you know, so just saturated with language because it's such a huge part of our
I
existence as
think
well.
maybe why it seemed valuable to me was because, as a dance practitioner myself, I'm always trying to challenge people's perception as of dancers not being academically intelligent or kind of switched on, or and I think I was thinking about the people, my peers at university, the people who have taught me, who have passed on their knowledge. I think dancers are probably some of the most academic people I've ever met, because of the way that we synthesize information and the way that it's embodied And it might, and I don't think, I think there's this false idea that being academic means that you have really good spelling, your grammar is excellent, and you can write 10,000 words in 2 days.
Well, I was going to say, it depends what you mean by academic, right? Like, so
Right.
with language, it's sort of going,
Yeah.
what are the associations that come with that? And
Yeah.
what does that actually mean? Like, when you say that, I guess what you mean is a certain kind of certain form of intelligence, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think a certain way of being academic to me is about investigating and not taking things at face value and researching for yourself. And regardless of whether you do that in an embodied way or you do that written way or both or any other way that someone might wish to be investigative, that is, they're all equal values, equally valuable forms of academia.
Yeah, but certain ones are more upheld more sort of highly in the
Yes.
depending on the cultural context that you're in. So that's why it can be important to kind of give voice to those other ways
And
of knowing.
correct me if I am wrong, Dance Geek, but is in the world of dichotomy, is language is a masculine tool, right?
Yeah.
It's language and the written word is seen as the male power. And I think that's really interesting when maybe queer, transgender, non-cisgendered people or women want to use language as a tool for themselves, how we kind of challenge those systems of hierarchy, because in and of itself, language is seen as a masculine entity.
Love that. Yeah. I mean, I think it's hard, isn't it? Because as soon as you talk about masculine and feminine, and then there are these sort of, or you know, these sort of polarities or identities can kind of come up, which is what Taos was saying, like, maybe I just don't believe in identity anymore.
Yeah.
But
Right.
I think you're totally right about that as well. And that even in a very practical sense, discourse in general came from, you know, male philosophers. And so
argument, reasoning.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
yeah,
exactly. But then there was this danger that sort of femininity and women were sort of associated with the body and nature and sort of primal urges or, you know, sort of organic. And so again, with any of these polarities, and we've spoken about this before, very much in relation to like what's considered appropriate for each gender in dance vocabulary, for example. So I think it's always about kind of challenging those things, for sure. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right that whole way, the way that we can appropriate language in different cultural contexts, and queer is, you know, the example par excellence, as they say, like the ultimate example. That's me being a massive, massive geek there. But that's like what you say when there's like the optimum example of something.
I love that, par excellence.
Par excellence. oh God. Yeah, of that queer being, you know, a slur that was then appropriated and turned into this kind of empowering. It's just the best. It just is the best example of the dynamic shift in the way that language can change its use. And yeah, I love that about it. So yeah, but
we
also
keep coming back to this. I'm really aware that like every time I have a conversation, we're just like, queer, it's great.
Well, what can you do? It just is. Yeah. But I really liked also what you said about synthesizing information, because I feel like I've just been watching my third year's final performances, you know, and they're the culmination of this long, long process, not only the rehearsal process, but also all the years of study. And this relates to any dance process, you know. And Taos was also talking about this, the way they're bringing in loads of different kind of influences from their own teenage years and from different contexts. And it was like sounding like quite an eclectic bunch of stuff. And then somehow we manage as performers or as makers, dance makers, to kind of bring together all these disparate things in this kind of nexus of the body, right? And it doesn't always, I think the thing is obviously then an audience might go, well, I didn't get all of those things from that. And in a way, that's not really the point, as is many discussions have been had.
Yeah. And
to this effect, also, but yeah.
It's also a really good reminder that someone's minority status within the wider world doesn't have to be their sole purpose of making art.
Right.
That we are more than just who exactly. we are as an individual. And exactly. I think even I went into listening to the interview with the expectation that you would spend the whole time talking about their gender identity as a starting point for creating movement material.
Yeah.
And actually, I think it's, yeah, regardless of who we are and how we identify, you can have so many more interests than just yourself.
This is so, and this is so important, right? Also, just socially, I had a really interesting conversation with a genderqueer person the other day, just socially, who was like, people just come up to me and project all their own gender stuff onto me. Yeah. And maybe you've had this experience too, because it's just like, of just kind of going, oh, maybe I see something in you that's a bit different. And so I'm going to like unpack all my own neuroses about my own gender identity. Oh, and you get, and they were saying to me, like, I'm interested in like Japanese animation. Ask me about that. Like, I study wildflowers in my spare time. Ask me about that. Like, I don't just want to have conversations about this stuff. And also that it's sort of a way for them to process that actually, yeah, that's not always available for discussion somehow. I don't know, it's a really interesting thing about how we present to the world, and then that's it being seen as some kind of open invite to just be commented on or like discussed, or I don't
yes to all of those things. And I've experienced that myself as well, in varying different degrees of just being like, I'm more than just me, which sounds crazy, but
well, it's more, you're more than just one asset. It's, we're all multiple, right? We're like, we're multiple exactly. beings. It's like when you get siloed, and it's, I remember feeling this when I was pregnant as well, that you kind of then get sort of, siloed like the cattle into this certain way of being or rung of life, and people kind of associate you with this one thing, and also feel like they can just touch your body without asking, and you're just kind of like, oh, actually, that I have some feelings about that I might, I might not want to, and I might also not have much in common with these other women who happen to be also growing humans at this time. So we've all had those experiences, and it's a good reminder. Yeah, Taos's response about not believing in identity was also a really good reminder to let go of some of that stuff for myself as well internally, of like, oh God, yeah. So yeah, I really enjoyed that answer.
Wow.
I love where we've got to, and now I don't know where to go from here. So maybe it's the end.
Yeah, maybe it's the end. And all I can say is just I'm really gutted that I can't be there in London on the 14th of June.
Yes, 14th of June. And I think I had that experience. I think Taos didn't know how far away I live from London, So I think, they were like, just come. And I was like, yes, I'm going to try. But yeah, really hope that some people listening to this get there and get to experience it, because it sounds wonderful. And the whole festival meltdown sounds amazing as well. And I'm definitely getting that in the diary for a future occasion, if not this time. So yeah. All right, Luca. You angel there in your white. Thanks so much, and I will see you next time. Hey, so for those of you new to the podcast, this is the section where I get my geek on. So I refer to it as the geek out, because it's a moment where I get to indulge my enthusiasm for dance related theory and discourse. I'm usually pretty disciplined about bringing in stuff from dance research and scholarship, partly because I feel like it's been a very marginalised form within the academy. It's a relatively young discipline, dance research.
And so for that reason too, I really like to try and share it with a wider audience. However, I also dip my toe into philosophy, and this month, in riffing on the themes that came up in the interview, I was reminded about the philosophy of Hannah Arendt. Now, you might have heard of Hannah Arendt because there was a film of the same name, which was kind of more about her personal story during the Second World War and her proposition of the banality of evil. So do check that out if you're interested to know more. But what it made me think of in relation to Taus's kind of articulation of dance as new beginnings was Arendt's sort of critique of male philosophers' obsessions with mortality as a basic condition of human life. So the fact that we're going to die. Sorry to bring that up on a sunny day. but Heidegger, who famously said, "We are born dying." And Arendt had a relationship with Heidegger, which again, if you're interested, go watch that movie. And she critiqued this obsession with mortality in a sense to say, let's also remember natality. So the fact that we've come into the world through being born. So natality is about beginnings. And there was a sort of hopeful philosophy around this, which was to do with the chance to begin again, I guess, through action. So Hannah Arendt believed in our capacity to act and for those actions to kind of instigate beginnings. And I felt like that really resonated with what Taus was talking about in relation to the materiality of the body when we step into a studio and we create something from nothing. Siobhan Katagu, apologies if I'm pronouncing that wrong, in her sort of analysis of Hannah Arendt's philosophy of new beginnings called Why the World Matters, which again is a kind of hopeful premise of like, even though things might be feeling pretty messy right now, it still matters. And she writes that natality entails the capacity to initiate or start something completely new. As the capacity to create, natality is necessarily linked with the plurality of the world. So yeah, again, as Taus spoke about the multiple influences that they are kind of invoking in their practice across the popular and the contemporary, I feel like that is really relevant. So every time we begin, every time we start something, every time we act, we are sort of drawing on these multiplicities, on the refusal to be defined as any one single thing or culture. So that is a little snapshot into the inside of my mind and the connections that I make between theory and practice. I hope you enjoyed it. If you want more, there's plenty more geek content on previous episodes. And next month's episode in July is the last one of the series. So do tune in for that. And I hope you are enjoying this sunshine and maybe even dancing in it.